value measurement. Okay, Aida.
Thank you, Hans.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. And I'm sorry that Hans didn't let you have any lunch until you discussed their value measurements. But on a positive note, I think all things are going pretty well here, so maybe we can be even quicker than planned. What was that? So we have an hour allocated for this session to discuss post-implementation review of IFRS 13, the standards about how to measure at fair value and what to disclose about fair value. This is agenda paper 5 that you have all received. The slides, what the slides do is summarize the feedback the board has received on the request for information. And a big, big portion of this feedback is thanks to the work you guys have done, and not only work in writing up and submitting comment letters to the RFI, but also all the outreach meetings you've had, the events you have organized, the research you have done yourselves. So really, I just want to thank you very much for this input. Nodding to Andrew over there, one of the events, very good events on fair value measurements earlier this week. So what we will do during this session is we would like to hear your takeaways on the feedback the board has received, and also hear your advice to the board with respect to any action to take following this feedback. I'm not going to go through the slides in the detail. I suspect you have all quite familiar with them, but I'm just going to summarize a few things, provide you a bit of a reminder of the background, the areas that the board has looked at in this project, the staff takeaways on this, and summarize the questions for you. So just a little bit reminder of the background and what this project is. So post-implementation review is a research project, and they have an important role to provide input to the board, helping them assess whether a standard that is being reviewed is working as intended and whether it is providing useful information to users of financial reports. So this is the objective of all reviews, including this one. So in this review, the board sought feedback from stakeholders using requests for information, and we have received 67 comment letters, and we have also, as a staff, held meetings with about 20 investor organizations in the comment period, and we have also done a limited research on application of fair value measurement in practice. What we have done in addition is commissioned an external group of academics to conduct academic review of academic literature that is relevant to fair value measurement. Unfortunately, this review was not quite finalized in time for this meeting, so I wasn't able to share it with you, but you will be able to see it when we post it for the board discussion. So to remind us that after post-implementation review, the reviews themselves don't change anything in the standards. They are research projects, and the board takes decision following review what action to take, if anything. And just to remind us all that having a review does not mean there is a standard setting to follow, although there might be some. Reminder of areas of focus in this project. So the board have narrowed the focus of this review on the areas that we have received most feedback during the phase one of the review, primarily usefulness of disclosures relating to fair value measurement. But we also looked at the unit of account, P times Q, application of highest and best use, for non-financial assets, application of judgments, in particular assessment of active market and unobservable significant inputs. And the board has also, although not strictly in the scope of IFRS 13, but has looked at challenges with measuring a particular type of assets at fair value, in particular biological assets and unquoted equity instruments. So these are areas of focus. Staff takeaways. I mean, I don't say this so much in the slides, but I was given a permission to give a little bit of kind of take it as a personal view of where we are going with this, although we are not formally making any suggestions just yet. I mean, the feedback really we have received has been consistent with the board has heard in the stage one of the project, which is a really good thing. So there was nothing new major that has come up that nobody has thought about before. But still, I mean, I personally felt this process was quite useful because getting the detailed responses helped us get further insight into the reasons for some of the differences in the views between preparers and users, and in particular in two areas relating to disclosures and relating to the unit of account question, but they were almost on the opposite side. But I think this outreach, and you will have seen this in the slides, have given us more flavor for why this is, and I think we're in better position to try to reconcile that. So my takeaway personally is that these are probably two areas that we would recommend to the board to perhaps look at further, again emphasizing not necessarily standard setting action, but look at further and see what more can be done to kind of reconcile the views and improve the reporting. With respect to other areas in the request for information, I mean, personally, I mean, I do recognize that there are challenges, and of course, this has come across in some of the feedback received, but overall, again, I think personal impression is that the board is really shouldn't do anything further or doesn't need to do anything further in these areas, but recognizing that there might be a scope for facilitating consistent application, for example, by encouraging development of valuation guidance on biological assets, developing by someone else, but the board promoting perhaps this development to help people that struggle with this in some jurisdictions. So this is, and again, I have to caveat, you know, just my view and nobody else's, and this takes me really to what questions we have for you today. So they're on the slides 5 and 6. We have two sets of questions, and I would suggest we start with questions on slides 5. So they relate to disclosures. So we have grouped them, discussion on disclosures and then discussion on other areas that were the subject of the request for information. And with the disclosures we had, so what I would like you to discuss, your general impressions from the feedback we have received, the advice you have for the board following this feedback, and also if you would like maybe to make comments or references to what is included as suggestions, specific suggestions that we have heard relating to disclosures that are set out on slides 23 to 25. So if you do have any comments, observations on those, please include them as a part of your response. So if you could discuss anything you have to say on disclosures perhaps first, and then we will discuss your advice on other areas. Thank you.
Andreas?
I think my comment on disclosures would equally apply to the rest of the standards. How do you judge whether the standard is functional or dysfunctional? Because only then would you have a robust ground to actually dig into something and say, well, do we have to do something? My impression is that most people believe that IFRS 13 is working, but the complaints relate to side effects of that standard, not to the core issue of how do we measure things. Take P times Q issue aside for a moment, because that's one important exception. But I think else, I haven't heard much. And that may be due to the standard is fantastic because it was jointly developed with the FASB, or we don't care at all. We just use other metrics. We employ loads of consultants who help us in compiling all the data. So I would say that from the measurement perspective, I see less of an issue. The issue seems to be mostly in the disclosure bit. And I think the complaints that we have heard tie neatly into what we've just discussed about principles of disclosures. So I think the core issue is not the generation and proliferation of the fair value information. It is about the perceived unusefulness of the information. People complain because they have to do something that they don't see any benefit, but it is costly, and it is costly on a repetitive basis. So here, for me, it would be very difficult to judge whether the standard is working as intended. And the only way to find that out is, are users using the information that people believe are just costly to comply with? And I think there is probably anecdotal evidence that we see that many are not using the data the way. And if that's the case, then I would say, yeah, you could probably say that the standard is dysfunctional in that regard. Now, how to do something about it is probably the more tricky part, because nobody laughs if information is being taken away, whether I'm using it now or might use it in the future, who knows. But to substitute, I think, is one way of looking at the issue and say, well, could we perhaps see what the basis for this was? What was our objective? And are there other means, cheaper ways, probably more effective, or even ways with the same effectiveness level that would do the job as well, rather than compiling loads of tables and reconciliations that really have little meaning for those whom we want to provide the information to. As regards the P times Q, or shall I park that one deliberately because you concentrate on disclosure?
You could park it because that's if you fine. Start and everybody will talk about that.
Okay, I'll pause that.
Tricia.
Well, thank you, Hans. I'm pleased to hear that we're constant. We're not necessarily constantly helpful, but we do try to be consistent. We heard back that basically the standard is useful, the disclosures are useful. We didn't have a significant number of people coming back saying that they didn't like the disclosures. The suggested additional disclosures that you picked up on your slide, such as the level one, level two split between realized and unrealized, were certainly looked for by the investors we spoke to. But I think on the disclosures front, we didn't have a problem. We got support for what the standard's doing.
Yukio.
Thank you, Hans. First of all, we appreciate ISB staff for summarizing the feedback from the request for information on the PIR. Our understanding is that the agenda paper generally reflects our stakeholders' views. Reviewing the feedback for the fair value measurement disclosures in the agenda paper, we are aware that there is a much debate on cost and benefit for some level 3 disclosures, such as reconciliation from the beginning balances to the ending balances, and quantitative sensitive analysis. I'll give you four comments responding to question 1C. Firstly, regarding the reconciliation, some users in Japan noted they would like to understand the reason for the changes in the level 3 balances, but they did not stick to a reconciliation or a tabular format. In addition, some preparers noted it's important to identify what information are presented in the reconciliation is useful to the users. Secondly, regarding the quantitative sensitive analysis, some users noted that usefulness would be limited unless underlying assumptions and scenario were clearly stated. Some preparers also argued that a quantitative sensitivity analysis may not be useful because underlying assumptions and the scenario highly dependent on management judgment. Thirdly, regarding expanding disclosure for level 1 and level 3 asset to include unrealized gains or losses, some users expressed mixed views as to the usefulness. Some preparers noted that such disclosures are not useful because level 1 and 2 assets are highly liquid. Finally, regarding including weighted averages in the disclosures of ranges of unobservable input, some users and preparers noted that calculation method of weighted average of input is not clear, especially for derivatives, and that such information is not useful.
Gary?
Thank you, Hans. So in Australia, we did our own outreach activities, and the feedback we received was largely consistent with what was summarized in this paper. But there's also a lot of echo with what Andrea said. A lot of constituents expressed their concern, or I don't want to say frustration, but with the level 3 sensitivity analysis. Yes, they find it difficult to apply, but I think the more overarching issue is that they come up with results that don't really make a lot of sense. If you look at some of the, maybe the level of aggregation was too high, if you look at a range that is from 0 to 2,000% or something like that, you know, what usefulness is there in it? So we do have one suggestion, and that came specifically from our constituents. If they're not necessarily opposed to it, but they would appreciate a little bit more guidance, and maybe in the form of some sort of an example, a practical example that can make this real for them and easier to apply and hopefully get it right. And one thing that I have to emphasize is this issue is quite prevalent in Australia, not only for for-profit entities, but also for our public sector entities, because they fair value literally everything on their balance sheet. So, and they follow IFRS. So it is a big issue for us, but we think it can be solved or addressed by just providing some real-life examples. Thank you.
Linda?
Thanks. The feedback that we've received is generally consistent with what you have in the summary, but it kind of fell into two camps, I would say, financial institutions versus non-financial institutions. Non-financial institutions largely get frustrated with the level 3 disclosures, although they typically don't have a lot of level 3 assets. So then you say, well, why are they complaining about it? Well, they're complaining about it because of the notion of the securities regulators really focused on that. And they're focused on that because if they feel that if they don't see that disclosure, the entity isn't giving, you know, the picture of any underlying risk associated with the judgments made in actually valuing the level 3 assets. So that's a ripple on impact in terms of, I think the only way you can influence that is through saying if it's not material, blah, 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 and reinforcing that. I don't know that necessarily changing any aspect of IFRS 13 is going to fix that problem. On the financial institution side, they are well equipped to deal with these disclosures. They understand how to do them, but in fact, the level of assets in level 3, or the amount of assets in level 3, has fallen dramatically for a variety of reasons, the proportionality since the credit crisis. So they're wondering if now some of the roll forwards, et cetera, are really giving relevant information, and would there be other ways to achieve the same objectives? All said, I guess from my standpoint, having been in financial services, it would concern me if you suddenly decided to strip out a lot of things that you would then overcorrect for any situation, in terms of level 3 disclosures per se. Because I do think that and the sensitivity analysis type disclosures are really important when there are a significant number of assets. So, all said, I think at the end of the day, while there may be some grumbling, the underlying standard seems to be working. It came about in many respects because of the credit crisis. People seem to think it served well through the credit crisis and beyond. So hard to disagree with major surgery, you know, that you don't need to do major surgery.
Lynn?
Thank you. Based on our outreach, we also think that the standard is working well, and people just ask for further guidance at the moment. So we suggest the board to be providing more guidance or education materials on many challenges, such as the application of judgment on active market, how much is sufficient frequency and volume, and highest and best use. And on behalf of the AOSSG, one member thinks that the cost-benefit analysis should be done sufficiently for any additional disclosure requirement, and the priority for the board is to tackle the application issues.
Help.
Echoing many of the comments that have already been made, we have an active project looking at the disclosures on fair value. We'll come back to board deliberations first half of next year. A lot of what is on page 23, I think we would generally agree with in terms of additions and deletions. Right now, though, we're testing, basically, and we have in the past tested our decision or disclosure framework against various standards, including the fair value standard. So it's been a somewhat an iterative process. And what we're finding is that the disclosure framework is actually helping us think through in a more consistent way. And we actually think of that framework as a educational tool for new board members as they come through. So as the board turnover, we're making consistent decisions. So it's a little bit of an advertisement for the framework itself. In terms of what was on page 23, we agreed with the unrealized gains and losses, and we've got a proposal to make some additional additions like yourselves. And in terms of the roll forward, we heard probably closer to the other investor comment that you make, don't take it out. So we somewhat split the baby here, and we're going to take it out for private companies but keep it in for public companies. You know, there's enough of a, we need that information, it's very helpful and useful, but we're not taking out the reconciliation completely. There are going to be some key differences or key changes from period to period in level three disclosed even for private companies. So I think very much we're aligned with what you're saying here. So not a lot of disagreement.
The feedback is very interesting. In fact, I would like to ask a question. What is going to be the consequence of the PIR?
I don't know.
Once we, you know, we have good feedback, some good suggestions. So, what's next?
Discussed it yet. Well, that's really the objective of this conversation. We want to get your feedback so that when AIDA takes those discussions to the board, she's got your feedback.
The board hasn't even discussed the feedback yet.
Yeah, we're discussing it before the board. So
it is for the next ASAP meeting.
Yeah, so also consistent,
no,
I think.
We are hearing interesting things right now.
Yes.
Yeah, so also consistent comments. I think that the standard has been working. And with regards to some of the disclosure questions, as I say, the suggestion would be is to, no, not actually do anything about them now, but deal with them as part of the Principles of Disclosure project. As they may be using IFRS 13 then as your one of your test cases.
That's why we did these two sessions, one after the other.
Pardon?
Okay, Aida. Yeah. Oh, Mary.
I was just going to come back a bit to Patrick's question. As you heard from the staff, The ASAF here is front-running the board in terms of receiving the feedback, you know, overview of the feedback. The context I wanted to offer is that after the staff completed kind of phase one of our PIR, there was a real question about whether we needed to even go out to do the full-scale external consultation. Decided, you know, on balance it would be better to get either verification about what we heard about the more challenging aspects, or either verification or alternative information. And largely, I think, as Aida said in the tee-up, the feedback has kind of confirmed our expectations of what we went out with. And so, you know, one of the reasons for coming to ASAF in advance of going to the board is to get, you know, some initial reactions. And, you know, the sense I have from looking at the feedback, this is a personal view, we haven't discussed it yet, is that this is a time when probably less is more in terms of a response. Now, I'm taking the comment that Andrea said at the beginning about let's deal with P times Q separately because we kind of have an open issue on that point. And we just have to close off, you know, where we are with that. But, you know, I think that's one of the reasons for coming to you at this point is my personal reaction in advance of us having a board discussion is, you know, little or nothing, kind of focused on educational and maybe principles of disclosure. And Linda, some of your comments made me think about, you know, materiality, you know, the application of materiality to some of these things rather than changing the standard. So, my first take listening to comments around the table is it seems supportive of that kind of low-key response. Just because we do a PIR doesn't mean we have to do lots of follow-up standard setting.
Quick. No, just to follow up on this one. Apart from P times Q, I'm wondering if the outcome of this consultation and the outreach events that have been carried does not imply maybe thinking a little more carefully than just saying, okay, we solved P times Q and that's it. I see a number of topics that are not only educational, but okay, there is a time, I know, there is always a balance between revisiting something and just implying educational, giving guidance. I know the board will discuss, make sure that, or establish, a, maybe the idea would be to establish a timetable for further consideration of some of the key points, which I think remain open. Personal opinion.
Okay.
So you may now make your points about P times Q.
I mean, you know my position on that one. I've said numerous times before that I believe that P times Q in this case is leading to false information of the market. And I think this, to me, is quite a strong case where I'd be more than happy to destroy beliefs of analysts and investors. Because I think what they are doing is simply dead flat wrong. If the market provides a number that clearly is not P times Q, then to say we nonetheless start with P times Q to me just doesn't make any sense. There's different ways to mitigate that, and I accept that. You could say we take P times Q, but then we ask people to elaborate in their notes as to where the difference comes from. But we could also take it the other way around and say let's apply the real measure and then give a justification as is set in the slide deck as to why have you deviated from P times Q, and please elaborate on that. But to say that, and the cases, I mean, as I've said in this, there are not many cases where we've seen that in practice, but every time where this issue is relevant, we are talking huge numbers. Mm-hmm. And if we are talking huge numbers, I think I've become very sensitive to reporting a number that I just believe doesn't make any sense because it doesn't reflect reality. And this is why I use that harsh wording and say it is just dead flat wrong. That's my position in this case. So I would be probably more sympathetic to say, whether you frame it as a rebuttable presumption or something like that, and say in this case where there is a huge differentiation, include the number that actually you have paid, but provide an explanation, a reconciliation as to P times Q, and try to be as specific as to the extra factors that usually we wouldn't include in fair value measurement. But if everybody knows that there is some sort of blockage or control premium, I mean, to just say our standards doesn't provide for that, to me that is a very bad reason. I think you better be thinking the other way around. If markets usually price in something extra, shouldn't our standards be reflective of that?
It's just quite interesting. I'm sorry to interject, because I completely understand where you're coming from, and I saw it, if these things exist. But then users, several of them, have challenged this very premise where you say it is known that there is control premium. They actually say, no, there isn't. Often there isn't. People just assume because you have a certain number X that is more than lower number of X shares, there is something there. But they say in reality there often isn't. And what they say is market is beginning to wake up to this, that recognize that it is not by the default that these premiums or discounts in some cases exist. And this is part because in stage one, the limited feedback we have had suggested, is this really verifiability concern of users, and they just want the number that is verifiable, and they know it's wrong, and they adjust it. But these additional discussions we have had to them led me to think it's not just that. It's also that sometimes it's free, people throw their money away, and that these things don't exist, and in reality they don't actually have value. And it was quite interesting for me to find that out and kind of see it. It's hard to see it as a black and white, I think, and go either way, unfortunately, like everything else in standard setting. So I just wanted to share that.
Fair enough.
Sorry, if I could just respond to that. Just based also what on Andrea said, are they saying that there is evidence that transactions take place at a value that is P times Q? And that the amount that is paid is not higher than P times Q.
They just say they overpay the market, right?
Yeah,
and the market reacts afterwards.
I think they don't necessarily think it's because of control per se.
Yeah.
There's lots of things, and bear in mind P times Q arises in many situations. It's not just in acquisition. Acquisition is one of them, but you also have subsequent when you have impairment testing and when you have, all kinds of situations. So it's a more broader, it doesn't always happen when you give certain money and say, I paid this. And
well, the reason why I asked that was because I think that there is a concern with whether or not it's a day one or it's a day two loss. So you make this acquisition and you say, I'm prepared to pay X amount for this, and that's what you pay. And then your subsequent measurement says fair value, but you must use P times Q. And I would have thought that in many instances that then results in a day two loss, because that P times Q is not reflective of the way the initial purchase price was determined. So that's why I'm saying is, if they are saying that there's no evidence, are they saying that transactions take place at P times Q, or are they saying that, well, if they don't, people are just overpaying, and are they therefore saying, well, a day two loss is appropriate because that value is not there and people are just overpaying? I mean, is that the reality of it?
Well, I think they do say people overpay a lot. I mean, obviously, I didn't quiz them and say, shoot me, give me the transaction, show me the numbers. It was more general discussion. But I got a sense that, there is that. And I also got a sense that the market is changing and that people are recognizing that these things don't exist by default. But sometimes they exist and sometimes they don't. And the numbers are questionable.
This whole P times Q thing worries me a lot. I mean, I understand the relevance point that people raise, but I also worry that investors are so strongly in the other camp. And I also think we have to be a little bit realistic that a lot of people still have worries today about things that are level 3 type measurements, and they worry about distributions being made on that basis, and all these prudence arguments and uncertainty of measurement arguments come up that we've been trying to deal with in the conceptual framework. And I think that what investors are saying is, if there is a, some sort of anchor that's market-based, we feel much more confident sticking with that anchor. And I think that's a lot of what's coming through. Now, that's, you can argue about whether that's right or wrong. But I think one of the things that's worried me is this whole conceptual argument that we started to have when we were talking about it before, which is what Aed is alluding to. Is it really a control premium? And when do we start opening the blockage discount debate as well, which is well before you even get to control on a converged standard? And also, the other thing that always, while I understand that people are worried about the relevance of the number, I also worry about how quickly preparers seem to want to go all the way from P times Q to discounted cash flow analysis, as opposed to doing some sort of level two, which is starting with P times Q and then sort of making some, you know, adjustments. It's like it's all bets are off, and we're way over here doing PV calculations. And then how do we control that? I mean, so I think we have to be careful.
Linda.
Just a quick comment, though, in terms of, you know, people get really agitated about this. A little bit like the question, have you stopped beating your wife? And, you know, like, if you answer yes, it what means you were beating your wife, and if you answer no, you're still beating your wife, whatever. So, I mean, I think there's a gem in here about evidence, and that we should actually perhaps hone in on. Whenever I get people with warring factions, I try to go back to the data so that we can have a more articulate conversation. And I thought it was very interesting you said that you know, questions you may or may not ask users. So because I've been spending so much time with users lately, you have to understand that in general, this is an overgeneralization, but in general, users will have suspicion on the degree of subjectivity that management may put into a particular estimate or calculation, that they will always do it to benefit themselves, they will always do it to benefit their compensation in that particular period, yada, yada, yada. And so my question on P times Q would simply be, are there factors we can delineate where P times Q would be the better estimate versus where, you know, I like what you said, Sue, because instead of going all the way to the level three, can you actually say you start here, but there are logical adjustments you may make that would give you a better number? And one of the things you can think about in that regard is, do you have something that was valued at P times Q, and then in subsequent financial statements, there's a material gain or loss as a result of that root valuation because the marketplace adjusted that number when the actual transaction was done. So I know in our jurisdiction there's a big concern over a simplistic P times Q. And when you talk to valuation experts, of course, they're biased because they want to be hired to do valuation. But in reality, they say, well, you, and they can list off the number of factors that this P times Q hasn't taken into consideration. So there's something there. And I resonate with you, Andreas. I won't maybe go quite so far to say it's dead flat wrong. But usually when you see something material, it is material to the entity. It's not small. Yeah. And so that's why people get so frustrated with this issue. So I think there's something there.
Patricia? Well, Europe still is consistently split with our users on one side and our preparers on the other. And the auditors, I think, are edging towards the users. Where, to the extent that we've heard a reason why users prefer P times Q, it's very much verifiability.
Yeah.
It's not been that this is an invented number. And I think I'd pick up with Linda that we get these problems when we change unit of account. So if we can see that we're going to measure acquisition unit of account on one basis and the change the unit of account for future measurement, maybe we ought to start at initial recognition, trying to identify how we value the other bit of the unit of account, because we're taking bought in a block and converting it to individual equities. And if there is a valuation difference between the two, maybe, and this is what Linda, I think, is suggesting, is we need to capture the reason for that difference at the beginning and account for it at that point appropriately with the reason. So, we've seen this in other cases where we change unit of account, that people get confused because they want consistency from initial measurement to subsequent measurement, and it's when it falls apart that everybody gets anxious.
Leonardo?
Yes, thank you. I just want to reiterate some of the comments of Andreas and Linda. We think that the fair value of a subsidiary should include the control premium. And in 2014, we compared the share price of 200 public offers before and after the transaction, and we noted a significant difference of the price. Now, in our view, this difference is due to a control premium. We don't think that is overpayment, but we cannot verify this.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. So if I may, I will kind of summarize my takeaway from this discussion. The standard is working well, generally, and with respect to areas other than disclosures and units of account, I haven't heard a major support for the board to do anything in this, and particularly not in the near future. With respect to disclosures, I've heard some appetite to look into this area, but subject to considering all the implications of the work on the pod, on the materiality, and perhaps consider those together and, you know, with the board's priority and the timing, etc. With respect to unit of account, I've heard that although we have found and you have found that the issues are rare in practice, but because they are material to those to whom they happen when they happen, the view is that the board should continue working on this and do something. I mean, obviously, post-implementation reviews research project is not a project where the staff make suggestions to the board exactly what to do, but you know, the view is there's something to be done there, and, you know, we will still have to work on, you know, how the communication about this is going to happen and what is realistic, given that the board has had a go at this in past, and it wasn't so easy, but I hear clear message from you that, you know, we have to keep trying and, you know, work to find a way, even though it might not be as black and white as some may want. So with that, unless there are any objections to this, thank you very much for your time and input.